On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the luxury episode of Slate Money Swag, a mini season where we talk about silver, wine, art, gold, and all manner of asset classes which don't have cash flows but can still rise in value. Today, I'm quite excited that we're going to finally talk about luxury goods. We're going to talk about handbags and watches and sneakers and all those things where people are like, you know, those things can be an investment. And I am joined by Max Bittner. Hi, Max.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are the CEO of Vestiaire Collective, is that right?
Correct.
This is a platform, we will talk about this in a minute, where people can buy and sell such things. And we are going to talk about how much you really need to spend in order to have an investment grade handbag. Spoiler alert, it's actually lower than the amount you need to spend to have an investment grade work of art. So that's exciting if you want to get into the handbag market. All that coming up on Slate Money Swag. So Max, so far on this show, we have talked about gold, we have talked about Bitcoin, we have talked about art. All of these things are things that on some level people think of as an investment. And you're here and you're going to talk to me about luxury goods. And I always historically have thought of luxury goods as consumption goods. If you have too much money, one of the signs that you have too much money is you go out and spend thousands of dollars on objects just because you can. And you have a company called Vestiaire Collective.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the ideas there is that if you consume goods by going out and buying them, that like you haven't completely just set your money on fire.
Yes.
So explain that to me and explain the idea of the mechanism by which luxury goods and things that I buy in stores can in some way like retain their value.
Sure. So I think just step back, you know, what it is we do. We're a platform where individuals on a C2C basis sell the items that they own to other people within our bigger community. We act as a middleman, as in we check the authenticity of the products. We curate the products that get onto our platform. But in the end, it's a platform where people buy and sell luxury and affordable fashion. And, you know, the idea behind it is that any product on our platform has a value, and that value is different to different people at different times of the life cycle of the product. So compare it to flying from New York or London, and you equate that to an Hermes bag. The person who has an Hermes bag, which is uniquely made for just them, is the person flying on a private jet. The person who buys an Hermes bag directly into the store without having to wait is the person flying first class. The person having a Hermes bag and has to wait for 9, 12, 18 months to get the bag is flying business class. And you basically go down the aisle.
And the person who buys knockoff on Canal Street
is flying Norwegian. and in the end, it's the utility of the product is the same one. Everyone is crossing the Atlantic in some sort of way. But we basically find the right time and the right ownership at the right time of the life cycle of that product.
Now, in terms of the product, the custom bag to one side, but clearly, if I walk into a store and buy an Hermes bag versus if I walk into a store and put my name on a waiting list and then get it 18 months later, the bag is the same and the value of the bag, the secondary market value of the bag is the same in both cases, right?
Yes. But you have probably spent much more money in Hermes previously to just walk in and get a bag.
Exactly. So the value of the bag is not really, or not mainly, a function of how much it cost in the first place.
It's the availability also.
what drives the secondary market value? Like, and what is there any relation to the primary market value? Like,
yeah. For so instance, I think second, the value of a secondhand good is driven by two major, you know, fundamentals. The first one is the depreciation of the item. You know, how old is the item? How much has been used? So the value of the item is defined by some sort of mechanism where you say the product is worth 60, 70, 80%, or potentially north of 100% after 6, 9, 12 months.
Of like the original retail
price. Of the original retail price. The other big fundamental is how hot or exclusive or unique that item is. You know, that's driven by the trends, that's driven by the rarity of the product. And that's basically an axis where you think, okay, the value can go up or down based on these two major fundamentals.
And in terms of the luxury world in general, if I go to a major shopping district in New York or Paris or any other rich city, if I buy an item, I'm not really in that world, but like normally if I just walk into a store and buy an item, it doesn't occur to me that that is some kind of a scarce product, that like if I buy it and I like it and I say this is really cool and I go to my friend and say, hey, you should buy one of these, it's really cool, it doesn't occur to me that I bought like the last one and they're not going to be able to. But on some level, what you're saying is that the value of these objects is driven by the fact that the manufacturers just stopped making them at some point.
Well, I think if you look at certain brands, they've made a whole business out of making the item that they sell scarce. Yeah, so you can't just walk into any Hermes store, you can't walk into Patek Philippe store and buy any watch that you want. Certain bags or certain watches are not available. So there is a scarcity.
And,
so
I think do they do that because they want these items to retain the secondary market value, because they want people to think this on some level is an investment? Or is that not the primary reason why they do that?
No, I think the primary reason to do is to charge a very high primary price in the initial sale. And if you look at the luxury industry, you know, over the last 10, 20 years, you know, what has happened is a dramatic inflation of the prices at which products get sold. I give you the example, you know, I used to be a junior consultant, and back then consultants had to wear suits. And I had the option to buy, you know, a 250, 300 euro Hugo Boss suit. I'm German, so Hugo Boss is the only reason I would wear Hugo Boss. And you know, a Zegna suit at the time would cost 850, 900 euros, which I couldn't afford at the time. Now, fast forward 10, 15 years, that same Zegna suit is costing $2,500. The suit is the same. The quality is the same. That's not the inflation of the prices of the material that is being made of. That is purely, you know, the ability of these luxury brands to charge a premium. And one of the reasons you can charge a premium is of course, that sense of exclusivity, that sense of uniqueness that the owner of that product in some sort of way wants to show off.
And how does that play into the, I mean, presumably suits are never going to be a very good investment because they're literally tailored.
Yes.
But things like handbags, which are not literally tailored, are more likely to be able to rise in value. Is there a syndrome where people either buy pieces on the primary market because they think that they will hold their value, or buy pieces on the secondary market because they think they are going to rise in value? Does that happen?
I think there's absolutely that kind of speculation that is growing. I think you see that especially happening in the sneaker market right now. You have platforms out there like StockX where people buy items and they never actually own it. They store it at StockX and then resell it, and they never actually have the item in their own possession. But I think a big lion's share of consumption, it's still people buying something for themselves. And I think what we're trying to educate consumers about, that they're not buying consumables but assets, is that they, you know, think about the initial purchase price not on its own, but also think about the fact that they can sell this again. And you know, Vestiaire Collective is not just about educating people that people are buying assets versus consumables. Vestiaire is really there to promote circularity in some sort of way. And in the bigger kind of zeitgeist shift that we're seeing, where sustainability is playing a much bigger role in people's decision-making process when they, you know, acquire something, you know, we try to educate people in saying that there are certain products, and luxury, you know, products are, you know, the best example for that, where by educating consumers that these are assets which have a resale value, they might change their decision-making away from buying cheap, fast fashion and trade up. Instead of buying, let's say, a first-hand Michael Kors bag, they buy a second-hand Gucci bag. And the idea behind that is that the longer every item is worn, you know, every 2-3 months you extend the life cycle of a product, you dramatically reduce the emission, which then has an impact, you know, on the planet in some sort of way. And by finding the right owner for the right product at the right time, you promote what is a more sustainable consumer behavior.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
One of the questions I had about gold coins was like, what is the round trip cost of buying a gold coin and selling it? Or to put it a different way, like how much does the value of a gold coin need to rise in order for me to break even on buying it and then selling it? And the answer there was about 5%. Mm-hmm. In the case of a Gucci handbag, what's the answer to that question? If I go onto your website and I buy a bag and then I immediately turn around and sell it like the following day and it hasn't changed in value, like how much of a haircut am I going to take there?
You know, I think the average logistics cost of shipping the item from the seller to us, for us to authenticate it, and from us to the buyer, depending, of course, how big the shipping route is. Let's say you're sending something from London to Paris, would be, let's call it $40-50. So depending on the primary price of the item that you're selling, you know, that's where you get your percentage and how much it costs.
And when we were talking about art, Julia Halperin told me that art only really becomes an investment good as opposed to a consumption good when it starts costing more than about $500,000. Is there a similar price point in luxury, whereas like when it's cheap, it's just something you buy and consume, but above a certain level, it becomes something you can start reselling and that might conceivably go up in value?
Yes and no. I think that's really much tied to the scarcity of that product. So things can go up in value even at a much lower price point. You look at some of those, you know, unique Air Jordans that are out there, sneakers or very rare, you know, other pieces of fashion. The whole idea of a drop and the concept of keeping that supply limited and creating a frenzy about getting that item at that first drop results in the immediate appreciation for people who don't have the time to stand on the computer or stand outside a shop and wait for that item to come. So that investment is not just for really expensive items.
So that, I mean, that
but that is in some sort of way also a speculation kind of effect that will have an appreciation.
Right. So I can make an almost guaranteed profit if I stand in line outside Supreme waiting for a drop, buy a hoodie and then sell it on eBay. Like that's,
I mean, at the moment, I mean, considering the hotness of these kind of products, you can probably assume that, yes. And there's students and, you know, even high school students who make, you know, a killing out of that, yes.
But
it's, I mean, I would not say that this is a long-term investment strategy, and I don't think you will have hedge funds being formed around this individual thesis. Yeah.
No. Do you know anyone who considers any kind of luxury good to be an investment?
Yes and no. I think the main thing what we're trying to say when we're saying these are assets is that in comparison to consumable, the item is not worth nothing after you're done wearing it however many times you like wearing an item. And that by being able to sell it in a second market and us, you know, empowering you through our community to find a buyer for that, it is not lost money. And it basically helps you to change your perspective on how much you're willing to spend a bit more on high quality products, which have a longer lifetime than items which, you know, have a, you know, fall apart after washing 5-6 times.
Give me some price points here. So if I go along to your platform and I want to buy a investment grade handbag, mm-hmm. say, that will maybe not retain its value, but at least not like just evaporate in value, how much will I need to spend?
I think most of, if you look at these you know, higher price point items, such as handbags and watches, you know, which, you know, I would start at 1-2,000 euros or US dollars. You know, you're talking about your basic Chanel timeless bag. You know, you're talking about your lower end Hermes bags, your Louis Vuitton bags. Those items, you know, after 12, 24 months can easily, you know, keep the value at 80-90% of the original purchase. And the higher you go and the rarer the product is, and, you know, you talk about your Birkin bags, which cost, you know, 8, 9, 10+ thousand US dollars or euros, you know, a lot of these actually keep their value or even increase because of the sparsity. And you know, very often this time of year, you know, a lot of our buyers of Hermes bags, you know, happen to be men, not women, because, you know, they realized too short that this time around they felt really guilty and they wanted to give their wife a really expensive present. And they walk into an Hermes door and they realize, oh, I should have done this 6-12 months ago or even more. So they come on the platform. At that point, their price sensitivity is, you know, equal to zero because they just need to get that and they need to get it within days or weeks. So there's
a seasonality?
If
I want to sell my Hermes bag, I want to sell it around November time, December?
Absolutely, yeah.
Does that apply to watches? Well, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think watches is a very traditional present that you give someone. And, you know, when do people give presents? So watches are, you know, definitely see a cyclicality. And luxury goods overall, of course, this time of year, November is a good time for business.
Are watches a separate, like a distinct and separate asset class in their own right? I kind of get the feeling that, you know, there have been watch auctions at Christie's and Sotheby's for decades, that somehow it's a more established market than the rest of it.
Yes. And if you look at the secondhand market, the size of secondhand of the total watch market is much bigger than you would see that in luxury fashion. You know, luxury bags, again, is higher than, let's say, ready to wear, which is more difficult to sell because you have the differences in sizes or not. But I think watches is, you know, has absolutely quite an evolved and sophisticated resale market. And the luxury brands, so the watch makers, have been quite actively involved in that resale market already, with luxury players buying secondhand platforms and working, you know, very much hand in hand, you know, to ensure that the secondhand market is managed and in some sort of way under their control.
They want the secondary market prices for their goods to be high because it makes...
I think they want to ensure that it's A, controlled, and B, you know, they want to limit the risks of people, you know, buying fakes or, you know, in the case of watches, very often, you know, there needs to be a bit of work done in the watch and to control the work that is being done in the watch, you know, in the actual mechanism or the wristband. You know, I think is also an opportunity for them to ensure that the promise they make to their consumers of the longevity of some of these very high-priced items is fulfilled.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
And the fastest growing segment, I think, surely has to be sort of streetwear and sneakers, and like, where did that come from, and is it a flash in the pan, or is this going to be around for a while?
I mean, I think it's a very good question. I think streetwear, the whole overall coolness factor of streetwear, has absolutely exploded, you know, over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And the, you know, my hypothesis is that the participants in that industry, you know, Supreme and Off-White, have just, you know, hit the nail on the head and targeted in a very sophisticated online audience with millennials and Gen Z. And they've picked up to this whole idea of resale, flash sales, drops, using social media to create some sort of a frenzy much better. While, you know, I think your more traditional luxury products and more traditional luxury consumers are by definition probably a bit older and less social media forensic, you know, than your Gen Z. But in many ways, we're now seeing an adoption of, you know, what the luxury players have seen happening with these younger Off-White Supreme-like brands and trying to bring that same uniqueness, sparseness, and social media frenzy to other products. So I think they've just been very good at innovating around that, and they have a very receptive customer base. You know, but the luxury industry has been very smart to catch up on that and, you know, communicate that to their consumers. And I think what we've done in Vestiaire, you know, especially since I've joined, you know, in my previous role, I ran a company in Southeast Asia, which was an e-commerce company. And the idea of a flash sale, you know, was very common. We had brands like Xiaomi or Motorola, which back in 2013, 2014 were just such hot products. We had flash sales where 20, 30, 40,000 people would be on the website and trying to buy it. And we would have a limited quantity of 5, 10,000 products that we would sell, and they would sell out within 30, 40 seconds. So for us, that was a very normal concept. And, you know, coming to Vestiaire and explaining to, you know, some of my new colleagues that, you know, the idea of a flash sale could be really exciting. You know, I think the first expression in their eyes was pure horror, because a flash sale is not something you would do, you know, for luxury, because the whole concept of luxury is that it's luxurious and not has a, you know, frenzy of that sort. But we've started testing with these kind of things, and it's, you know, in the end, it's nothing different than a drop, and consumers love it. I mean, they love having this ability to get excited about something. It's about engagement. How do we engage with our community? How do we bring people to the belief that consumption is can be fun? Yeah, and I think our consumers are buying into that a lot.
And how do you persuade sellers that they should? I mean, this is a two-sided market, or it's a three-sided market, because you're in the middle of it. But I can see how you can get buyers excited mm-hmm. about flash sales. How do you get sellers excited?
The way we convince sellers to participate in these, you know, flash sales or campaigns where they potentially drop prices versus the original price that they want to sell at is to mainly create awareness to their store. I mean, every seller on our platform is in some sort of way a micro entrepreneur, and that micro entrepreneur, you know, sits among many other micro entrepreneurs on our platform, and, you know, they're all fighting for, you know, what is our currency, and that's traffic. And how can you get people to follow your store is by creating awareness, and participating occasionally in one of these flash sales or campaigns. And once they create a followership of people onto their store that they can then directly communicate with sellers on the rest of their assortment that they're selling.
One of the things that we've seen in live music is the way that the official selling tickets at the box office is accounts for like 10% of the tickets now. And that really what all the bands and the venues do is they have an official face value, which they sell 10% of the tickets at, and then they sell the rest of them on, you know, StubHub or some other secondary market venue, and they get much more control over pricing and targeting and that kind of thing. Do you see a future where luxury brands increasingly sell directly into the platforms like yours rather than at their own retail outlets?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot of opportunities for the brands and the luxury groups to interact with their consumers in different formats than what they've experienced so far. You know, I think the name of the game is always about participating in the community, engaging with their community, not just, you know, at the primary sale. And if you think about basic customer acquisition for these brands, you know, having a store in Avenue Montaigne or in Fifth Avenue is quite expensive, you know, hoping that someone will walk past. Of course, you have the loyal customers who come, you know, buy these stores every time they visit the city or you know, travel to New York or Paris or London. But the customer acquisitions are quite high. So I think these brands are constantly thinking about how they can expand their potential customer set. And you know, if you look at Vestiaire, and we've done a lot of work on that. We just brought out a study with BCG. A lot of consumers on Vestiaire buy products and brands that they love for the first time secondhand because it is more accessible, it is slightly cheaper. And afterwards, they trade up in some sort of way to go to the primary sale. So for the brands to interact directly with consumers on our platform, I think is a, you know, win-win situation for us, for them, and for the consumer.
Thank you very much. This has been very illuminating.
Fantastic.